nature, the environment. Oh, thanks, Don. Anyway, I'm Laura Kahn. I chair the Environmental Advisory Council. Kathy, on to you.
Hold on. Okay, I was trying to unmute. Hi, I'm Kathy Fay. I am the Secretary of the Environmental Advisory Council.
Iris? Okay, well, Iris Kaminsky is another member of the Environmental Advisory Council. Florestine?
Hi, Florestine Taylor, member of the Advisory Environmental Advisory Council.
Okay. I think that's all the members we have at the moment. Maybe we'll get some more. Now we'll go to our city officials. Dawn, we'll start with you.
Hi, Dawn Henning. I help staff the council and facilitate from the engineering department.
Giovanni?
Giovanni Zinn, the city engineer.
Doug?
Hi, Doug Housladen, the Director of Transportation, Traffic, and Parking, and the Executive Director for the New Haven Parking Authority.
Okay. And now we will go to the other assembled people. Mary?
Mary's muted.
Oh, Mary, you're muted. Thanks, Steve.
Okay. I'm Mary Pasty, an interested citizen.
Thank you. Jeannie?
Jeannie Jabino, concerned and interested citizen and supporter of the EAC.
Hi, Jean Dubino. I'm Jean Connolly on York Street. I'm very interested in the environment. Thanks for letting me watch the meeting.
Thank you, Jean. Let's see, Aaron?
Aaron Good, Worcester Square resident, New Haven Bioregional Group.
Great. Kristen?
Hi, Kristen Barendrecht Ludwig. I'm the program coordinator for the Environmental Justice and Health Initiative at Yale School of the Environment, and also an interested citizen.
Great. Giovanna?
Hi, I'm Giovanna. I'm a physics student at Yale University and also an interested party.
Mary? Are you there, Mary?
Yeah, I am. Mary Woolsey, an interested citizen.
Great. Okay. Sid?
Hi, I'm interested in hearing what Professor Lamoureux has to say today.
Okay, so I think I got everybody, and I'm sure there might be other people who join us in the interim, but you'll just, you'll see their names, hopefully, and that will help. And our guest is Steve Lamoureux, who is an eminent physics professor and one of the world's foremost experts in nuclear energy, I might add. He's very modest, but he knows a lot, and we are very lucky to have him join us. I have put Steve's bio, a link to his bio in the chat box, so you can all see it there. And I just want to remind everybody that we're not meeting in July or August. Our next meeting will be in September. And anyway, we will talk about anything else we have to talk about after Steve shares with us his presentation. Hit it, Steve, and thank you so much for doing this for us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I've never really given a talk quite like this before, but about the time of Fukushima, when the Japanese reactor site, after the tsunami, reactor site kind of exploded, I had all sorts of questions. People were really scared. And anyway, that was the first time I gave a talk even remotely related to this, but this is a bit different today. And I'll try to go to full screen here. Is my screen showing up okay?
Yes.
You can hear me okay?
Yes.
nice and clear? And okay.
Yes.
So I'm going to talk today about nuclear power. I'm not advocating or saying it's good or bad. I'm just going to tell you what you might need to think about when you're assessing the funniness of power generation options. And in the end, the piper must be paid. A few years ago, nowadays I call it 10 years plus a few years ago, as part of the trouble of being over 60 years old, he wrote an editorial that we could all reduce our carbon footprint if everybody started driving electric cars. Well, whether this is true depends on many factors. You have, first thing you have to look at is, how is electricity used to charge a car battery being generated? What are the resources and energy needs to build electric cars along with infrastructure to keep the fleet running? And three, what are the long-term environmental consequences of the whole life cycle of electric cars and the associated power distribution and infrastructure? No, I'm not saying that electric cars are, you know, Teslas and whatever, cars that run on electricity are good or bad. I'm just saying that if you're going to really assess whether or not this is improving our, the way we generate power and our interaction with the environment, it's a tricky question. You have to look at every detail from beginning to end, cradle to grave. As a Didi, I learned this as a child. This is the cinder which came from the coal that burned in the fire, which boiled the water that made the stream, which drove the engine, that turned the dynamo, which produced the current, that made the light, which shone in the house of Jackville. Okay, well, there's a new horror movie out called The House at Jackville. This is an old poem that goes back to the 1700s or 1800s in England. The point of it is, this could be anything. This is the carbon dioxide that came from the coal that burned in the fire that is now causing global warming, or this is the nuclear waste that came from the reactor, or this is the dead battery that came from the Tesla, et cetera, et cetera. You can put anything in here that you want. And the point of it is, you have to look at every aspect of a problem when you're going to propose a solution. And one thing to look at is energy return on investment, ROI. You need to, one needs to consider all aspects of the infrastructure, from construction of the power generating devices, solar power, wind turbines, to the cost of distribution, copper wire. You know, it's not so widely known, but concrete and cement manufacturing account for 10% of carbon emissions worldwide. When you make concrete, you have to get the limestone, calcium carbonate, you heat it up, you use energy heating it up, and then when you heat it up, you drive off carbon dioxide and form calcium oxide, and that's what concrete is, cement's made with. The other thing you have to look at are maintenance costs and reliability. And I'll talk about nuclear power. Is it a proven technology? Maybe. It seems like rather brilliant people. I'll see if I can get my pointer to work. Whoop. Almost threw my joke away there. Well, I'm going to throw my joke away. Let's go see by brilliant people. This is Lisa Meitner, who discovered nuclear fission, working in Otto Hahn's laboratory in Berlin, Germany. This is Maria Geffert-Meyer, who came up with the shell model of the nucleus. Robert Oppenheimer, John von Neumann, Enrico Fermi, Einstein, Niels Bohr, Niels Zillard, and Madame Curie. So it's all conceived by rather brilliant people. The trouble is, and that industry ends up being run by folks like this. You know, this is the Fukushima top executives at EPCO, it's proven now they were more interested in saving money than they were in maintaining a safe operating system. This is the fellow who was in charge of the Chernobyl operation when that went crazy and made, not even arguably, absolutely the worst nuclear disaster in the history of the world, barring atmospheric nuclear testing. But, you know, it dumped about as much radiation into the atmosphere as an entire huge series of nuclear tests, maybe not all of them. A huge amount of radioactive material produced in the environment. So the question is, let's go back and look at Fukushima. This was really a disaster resulting from criminal negligence and incompetence. The meltdown could have easily been avoided. After that the meltdown occurred. I'll tell you in a moment what a meltdown is. It could have been easily avoided. TEPCO, Tokyo Electric and Power Company, insisted that needed to construct a 100-mile electric transmission line to supply power during the cooling system. In fact, all I do is have to bring an AV ship up near there and run cables over, and they could have turned on, provide emergency power for the cooling. And they didn't do this. They said they claimed that this was, they needed to spend months building something like this. In my opinion, that disaster is pivoted to the land grab. If I would have been there, I would have refused to leave my home. The radiation level is really significant, in my opinion. Of course, that's my own opinion. Others might disagree. I'm sure that there were some hot spots. But trouble is, all the infrastructure was shut down, water, electricity, hospitals, so you really can't live there anymore. There's no grocery stores. You're probably a pariah if you try to go back there and reclaim your life and your house and all that. So this was really handled very badly. From the beginning, they designed a facility with the emergency generators in the sub-basement, the nuclear storage of nuclear waste in the upper attic. And when they lost cooling power to both the reactor and the waste, what happens is if you don't have cooling power, you can turn off the nuclear reaction, you put it in the control rods or whatever. But about half the energy that comes out from nuclear power comes from the radioactive decay of the fission products. And there's various lifelines. Most of them are beta emitters. The famous one is strontium 90. That was the isotope that showed up in milk, dairy products. During the Cold War nuclear testing, one of the prime motivators for doing the comprehensive test ban treaty. That has a lifetime of, dozens of years. I can't remember offhand. But there's other, they're all beta emitters mostly. And they have lifetimes ranging from milliseconds to tens to hundreds of years. And then there's alpha emitters with hundreds and thousands, hundreds of years to tens of thousands of years. And the point of this, when you turn off the nuclear power, this radioactive decay is continuing to occur. And about half the total power that comes out of the generator nuclear reactor comes from these decay products. So if you turn off the cooling water, the reactor is continuing to heat up and eventually melt. And at some point, the radioactive core gets dispersed in the cooling water and steam boils away and carries all the radioactive products to the surrounding atmosphere, and if the containment building is breached, then radioactive waste is released to the environment. There wasn't so much of the breaching of the containment vessel in Fukushima. There were hydrogen explosions, and the buildings blew up. It looked horrible to see that on the news, and people on the West Coast, I'm from the West Coast, were very concerned that there should be a radioactive cloud coming across the Pacific Ocean, we're going to kill everybody on the West Coast. And my sister and other people all asked me, they need to start taking iodine and stuff like that. I said, look, there's just not that much there. It's not much is going to happen. And people are very scared seeing nuclear power plants blow up on the nightly news is a little bit unnerving. And it really sent a chill through all of society, throughout the world. And even the students at Yale were very concerned about this. And I gave a talk about that. And I sort of talked about the things I said here and how much radioactivity was released and all that. And basically I told not to worry. It's a little disaster. Things could have been handled better. But the reactor was very badly designed. But nonetheless, we were pretty safe. And history has proven that to be correct, unless they're not calling it something, but I don't believe in conspiracy theories. The Pacific Ocean didn't become radioactive or anything like that. It would be hard for us to detect anything now from Fukushima.
Hey, Steve?
Yes.
I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you.
Okay, I'll try to speak up a little bit.
Yeah, if you can adjust the mic or something.
Is it better?
Yeah, a little better. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. And, now, if we go back to Chernobyl, this was the worst nuclear disaster, again, due to criminal levels of incompetence. what happened there is they had a graphite reactor. With a graphite reactor, you don't have to have enriched uranium. You just use uranium that you mine right out of the ground. A very cheap way to generate lots of power. But the basic design of a graphite reactor is just unstable against the loss of water. And basically, that's what happened in Chernobyl. They were doing a test, and they pulled out the control rods too far. When they went to put in the control rods to displace water, that caused the reaction to take off, and the whole plant exploded. As a result of that, graphite nuclear reactors were banned worldwide. And, you know, we can ask how bad was this accident. I saw this article some time ago. It's from the BBC News Service. I basically copy it verbatim here. And I'll send the PDF of this talk to Laura. And you can all access these links if you're interested. Some studies claim that 1 million people died of exposure due to the toxic plume, which spread across Europe in the wake of the accident back in April 1986. And the NEI, the real numbers are a little different. And, you know, what the article suggests you do is brace yourself. According to the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, 28 staff and emergency workers died as a result of the radiation exposure. And, you know, this is a little hard to know, but I know Russian scientists who went there and worked and shoveled dirt onto the smoldering pile, and a lot of them ended up with strange cancers. One of my colleagues ended up with stomach cancer and had that stomach removed. But in regard to direct deaths and lingering deaths afterwards, there doesn't really seem to be so many. You know, there are also over 6,000 cases of thyroid cancer among people who were children or adolescents at the time of the accident. But, you know, thyroid cancer has a good survival rate. And as of 2005, only 15 cases had proved fatal. Now, I'm not saying that any of these casualties and damaging of people are insignificant, but, you know, it's trying to bring it into focus what the real consequences were. And those deaths that did occur were largely avoidable, the thyroid cancer ones, because these were caused almost entirely by the Soviet authorities' failure to prevent people from drinking milk contaminated with radioactive iodine. And indeed, during that time, the Chernobyl disaster, coupled with the shooting down of a civilian airliner, KL-007, were basically the two events that brought down the former Soviet Union. It showed that the ruling government was completely out of touch with what was going on in the world, were lying to the people. And, you know, there was serious political consequences from all of this. Now, if we continue on, according to the UN in 2005, just 43 deaths were directly attributed to the worst nuclear disaster the world's ever seen. And, you know, the true number of deaths will likely be higher than that, but not by much. So certainly there weren't millions of deaths. Thousands, probably not. Hundreds, probably, because we don't really know what happened to people in Europe. I went to Europe just in September of 1986, right after this occurred. Just about everybody in Europe, when they had their whole body dose taken, which I was working at a nuclear facility there and I had that done, everybody in Europe had a cesium-137 gamma rate from their body from having absorbed cesium, which is an alkali like sodium, potassium, and everything else. So your body just takes it up just like it would salt. Well, it's a gamma emitter, and everybody in Europe essentially had the peak. I, being fresh from America, didn't have that peak. And that was back in 1986. So I just point that out because all those disasters looked horrible. We didn't want them to happen. People were really damaged by it. It's not quite as bad as what you might think it was. And there's an interesting prehistory of nuclear power, too. 2 billion years ago, there was a ore deposit of uranium that actually turned into a natural nuclear reactor. And this was in Gabon in Equatorial Africa. And it was discovered because the French nuclear power industry had a mine there. And when they measured the amount of uranium-235, the isotope 235, which is the visible one, it was almost completely depleted. And it was a real mystery because isotopic abundance of the elements is almost constant from around the world. There's a few notable exceptions. Helium, the amount of helium-3 and helium varies, and the isotopic composition of lead depends on whether or not it came from decay of thorium or it came from the decay of uranium. But other than that, yeah, isotopic abundance of elements is very well known and very constant around the world. In fact, that's the way that rocks from Mars can be identified. You know, there can be cataclysmic meteor collisions with Mars that actually check rocks that end up falling on Earth, and they find these now and again. So anyway, this natural reactor occurred, and the analysis of the remaining isotopes in the uranium deposit there, a lot of the characteristics of the reactor be determined and operated as a long-term pulse reactor. You know, the lack of migration of fission products, you know, the nuclear ashes basically from the reactor are the existence proof that waste can be stored safely for long duration. That's not proof that any given facility is good or bad, but it just shows you that, you know, geological features can be stable on the order of 2 billion years. The way that this mine came about is uranium, when it's in a reducing atmosphere, it's not soluble in water. But a little over 2 billion years ago, blue green algae appeared on the Earth through processes we don't know. And that oxygenated the atmosphere. Before this algae appeared, the atmosphere of the Earth was basically unbreathable. Carbon dioxide, methane, hydrogen, who knows what all was in it. It was a horrible mix of gases, but the algae came along and they oxygenated the atmosphere. When they did so, rainwater became slightly acidic, and that would cause uranium oxides to migrate. When they would get to a place where it was reducing in a swamp or something like that, the uranium would precipitate out and form an ore deposit. And that's basically a mechanism by which many uranium deposits were formed. So all over the world, there's deposits of uranium just below the surface based on how this having happened. And that actually suggests a new way to mine uranium. And so the old-fashioned mine with open pit or anything else has been replaced by a sort of a fracking method. And actually, this was discovered in the context of fracking. They bring up the wastewater. It tends to be very highly contaminated with uranium, particularly in Pennsylvania. And this actually is a real problem. And there's a lot of controversy now in Pennsylvania about monitoring the wastewater from fracking. You can turn that around, you can actually turn this into an uranium mining operation. It's a very small scale compared to oil fracking. And basically you pump water down, pump it back up, you know, oxygenated, slightly acidulated water, and you pump it back up, and use ion exchange to extract uranium. And here's a barrel of uranium that was produced by this method. And it's interesting, one barrel of uranium can produce the same energy as 100 million barrels of oil. So you need a lot less mining, a lot less material in order to run a nuclear reactor. On the other hand, you generate nuclear waste, and you know there's engineering solutions that the political problem remains. And this, you know, historically, uranium was obtained by open pit mining. And here's a typical uranium open pit mine. I forgot to write down where these are. I just did a Google search of images of open pit mines for uranium and copper. But if you try to scale these figures against each other, this copper mine is 20 times bigger than the uranium mine. And there's hundreds of these copper mines all over the world. But anytime you're going to generate power, you're going to need copper, and the best way to get copper is these open pit mines, and these are going to exist no matter what kind of power you're going to try to generate. I just point this out because intrinsically, no electrical generation, distribution, infrastructure technique is really clean. It's all dirty somewhere along the line. And everything needs copper. So that's one thing you always need to think about. How much copper if we set up something? Like, say we set up a series of wind turbines along the coast. How much copper is that going to take to wire that all together? How much concrete are we need to sink into the ocean in order to mount these wind turbines? How are you going to bring this power all together and put it into an electrical grid? I contend that the amount of copper required for something like that is hundreds, if not thousands of times bigger than building a conventional power plant, which is one of the costs of the energy technique and something you work into the balance of the total cost of the system. And, you know, the other thing to think about is reliability. You know, if you how reliable is nuclear power? We saw Three Mile Island, a very small error caused that to go offline for a long time. We have wind turbines to be offshore. What happens if we have a freezing nor'easter and they're all covered with ice and a lot of them broken and damaged? How many weeks can we afford to be without power? I don't know. These are all questions that need to be answered in regard to any energy solution. My point of it is it's not simple. Nuclear power is one option, a suite of options. But, you know, this is my conclusion. This is a short 15, 20 minute talk. And, you know, assessing the safety, environmental impact of any electrical generation scheme needs cradle to energy use analysis that includes infrastructure needs, waste, handling waste and products, everything else. Diffuse electrical sources, wind power, solar power require much greater resources, copper wire and concrete, for the required infrastructure. You know, I mentioned icing, winter storm, repair costs, resource needs, reliability. And those are diffuse electrical sources. And, you know, all energy sources except solar, wind is a form of solar power, is driven by weather, and weather is driven by the sun, are finite on human scale. Oil, you know, supposedly it was going to be running out about now, but they keep on finding new deposits. Nuclear power, there's enough thorium-232 to last 10 to 100,000 years, but that would require building breeder reactors, and nobody really wants to do that because you have to make U-233, and that U-233 can be used, uranium-233 can be used as a bomb. But, you know, there's enough energy there to last 10 to 100,000 years. And, nuclear power, issue of waste is really the big lingering problem. It's been solved in the scientific sense, but not bureaucratically. You know, the United States built a waste storage facility in New Mexico, Nevada. Nevada was happy to take the money until the storage facility was finished, and they said that after it was finished that we don't want the waste, that they never took any of that site after spending billions of dollars building that. You know, nobody wants it in their backyard is basically what the answer is. And one thing is the insurance costs of nuclear power is going to remain an issue in the U.S. So whether or not nuclear power is viable or not, I don't know. But, you know, part of this, my presentation today is just really emphasize the point that every detail of the generation scheme needs to be carefully examined. For example, wind turbines offshore, what happens if things are vibrating? Is that going to affect the migration patterns of whales? All of a sudden, I don't know if you have humpback whales around here, all of a sudden, whales can start beaching themselves along the shores of Long Island. I don't know. It's one of those things that one has to do a careful study of all the environmental impacts and consequences, if anything, that we might propose for nuclear power. You know, for me, all I want is that when I turn the lights switch on, I want the light to come on. And at the stage of my life that I'm not going to be here that much longer. It's for the young people to decide what future you want, what they need. So But I just put this out there as a plea to carefully consider everything when deciding these types of issues. And, thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Steve. So can you tell us, does generating nuclear power put emissions into the air?
You know, in principle, I would say no, but you never know. And it's carefully monitored. There's stacks. As long as the facility stays intact, there really isn't any on-site generation of gases. Now, in the processing, I'm not sure how well that's controlled. The processing of uranium, you know, is fairly dirty industry, but, you know, to reduce the power needs doesn't really require all that much processing of uranium. It's 100 million times more energy containing than oil. So you need a lot less of it. But, you know, those are questions I really don't know the answer nowadays, what the issues are. I know that there's been times where nuclear waste in the reprocessing, they've had accidents, criticality accidents. You know, in the United States, we don't reprocess our waste, and that's thanks to Jimmy Carter. You know, I made a joke about, you know, the president deciding the national issues on these things. And in fact, the president really does have a lot of power. Jimmy Carter has an executive order that the United States reprocess nuclear waste. So there's a lot of potential energy just not being used. On the other hand, Japan and France both reprocess fuel. And I know in Japan there's been a criticality accident because, well, you have to dissolve the waste and then start concentrating the actinides. And if the actinide concentration, the actinides are plutonium, uranium, mainly. Those get too high concentration, basically get a runaway nuclear reaction. And once that starts, you can't turn it off. And usually what happens is the reprocessing vessel explodes. And that's happened a few times or two, at least one of those at Los Alamos. And there's one or two in Japan. So, you know, it has potential of releasing radioactivity, but, you know, barring a huge disaster like Chernobyl, mostly it's fairly easy to contain this stuff. Even Fukushima, there really wasn't a lot of stuff that got away, even though those reactor buildings exploded. You know, you can go in a protective suit just so you don't carry radioactive particles home with you and visit the reactors. Fukushima just, in fact, they could just basically scrub the whole area. At all, end up they decided not to do that. So, you know, in principle, the answer is yes, but in practice, if everything works right, which is always a kicker, there shouldn't be any emission at all.
Thank you. Okay, did I see Gene? Did you have a question?
I do. Dr. Amaro, I'm Gene Connolly. I'm only. Average intelligence, I wish you could convince me as if I were a third grader. Oh, bring the mic closer to your mouth, please.
Yeah, I try to. It's just, I think there's a lot of background noise in this room. And
yeah, probably. I embarrass myself by even mentioning it. I apologize.
Oh, no, that's okay. It's just,
thank you.
I tried to make sure that this...
You didn't convince me that we have solved the nuclear waste situation. You said that it's left to bureaucracy. I'm not being at all fresh. I'm just saying I'm not convinced, and I keep everything I read in the world, and I know I may read the wrong things, convinces me that we will never solve the problem of nuclear waste. And so we should just forget energy from nuclear source. I think I better stop talking.
Oh, that's okay. No,
sorry.
I tend to, you know, I agree. There's there is a scientific solution to the waste problem. You know, France's solution is to put it in concrete casks, drop it in the Atlantic Rift. I don't really personally think that's a solution. But, you know, if we reprocess fuel, separate it out for long-lived isotopes, reuse them for power, got rid of the ones we didn't want by putting them in glass at a safe concentration, they can be stored basically indefinitely. The Opal reactor phenomenon sort of shows an existence proof that if you have products generated from a nuclear reactor, that they can be geologically stable for 2 billion years. You know, that's an existence proof. It doesn't mean any solutions that's been put forward to date is necessarily correct, but we do have a natural phenomenon that suggests that it is possible to maintain control over the products over geologic time scale. So I'm not saying we really have a good implementation of that at this point, but we could have if we wanted to.
Is it ever frustrating to you that that is an enormous problem aside from politics? Is it frustrating to you?
Well, you know, a little bit because, you know, we're burning all this oil. Like 1,000 yeah. years ago, people are going to say, you did what with that oil? You know, what can you make with oil? All this plastic and everything, and you build things, and we're just burning it up. We're treating it like high fructose corn sweetener. And actually, oil is very, very useful for manufacturing. Chemical production, and we're just burning it all up. We're wasting a resource. That's what the real tragedy of fossil fuel and burning oil is, in my opinion. And, you know, of course, global warming is another problem. You know, I think anyway.
Thanks for your patience with me.
It's my pleasure.
Okay. You know, we have a couple of people who've put some things in the chat we could discuss.
I haven't been looking at that.
I know, it's hard to do everything. That's why I'm looking at it. So Kathy Fay, who is an Environmental Advisory Council member and deals with energy issues in her work, she writes, humans cannot escape the fact that human undertakings involve humans with all their character flaws. Human beings cannot escape the fact. And she writes that no matter where or how electricity is generated, transmission and distribution infrastructure, most of which is already built, is still required for the time being. And yeah, something else to consider. There are just so many considerations. And Mary Woolsey writes, even if the nuclear waste issue is manageable, the long time frame required to get new nuclear plants online means nuclear power won't be available to avert significant global warming for some time. Steve, do you have any comments on any of those things?
You know, so they're both correct. And, you know, in our current climate, it's just going to take forever to get new nuclear plants built. I'm not really proposing that we do that. And the point of my talk is just to point out the things you have to think about when considering an energy generation. You know, during World War II, nuclear power had not been really even discussed. In 3 years, they built nuclear reactors, built atomic bombs. And, you know, that's a time scale that is pretty remarkable. Now we say it's going to take us 20 years to build a nuclear reactor. And it comes down to what the will of the people out of this. You know, if people really wanted this, we could do it. Just take the Manhattan Project as an example. You know, I always think that when I'm looking at some, you know, project around town, I don't need to making light of any engineering project, but you know, you see a big project on the interstate. I remember there's one exit in New Jersey it was like 8 years they were working on this highway exit. I thought every time we drive by there, they built them through the Manhattan Project for 3 years to get this highway exit done in 8 years. You know, it's a question of the will of people. If enough people want something, it'll happen, it'll work. You know, America makes stuff work. But our response to the coronavirus and the vaccine, we pretty much smoked the whole world in getting our population vaccinated and safe and back working. Europe's behind. And if we wouldn't have been on the ball, we would end up like India. Look, they had that next wave, and you know, tens of thousands of people are dying today. We got the vaccine just in time. You know, if there's a will, we can make things happen. You got to remember that.
Yes. So, Kathy Faye, I think the Kathy Faye's microphone isn't working well. So, she asks why we don't take this opportunity to skip forward to solar generation. So my guess is that is what you told us, that nuclear energy is just so much more powerful and efficient than anything else, that we can't really find anything to compete with it.
Well, I think, you know, the solar is a real possibility. You know, people are getting solar panels installed on their house. If every house in the country had its own solar energy, would all our electrical needs be met by that? You know, I really don't know. And quite it is, it's going to take a large amount of materials to build that. And you have to look at the energy return on investment that's required for the upkeep of that, and what environmental impact is the manufacturing of the solar panels. As far as I know, manufacturing a solar panel could be worse than processing uranium for fuel. And you know, I just don't know. The whole point of my talk is to tell everybody to think about these problems. I'm either not advocating any solution or not advocating any, but one problem with solar power is it's a diffuse source. So, and diffuse sources require a lot of infrastructure, you know, either local in the case of solar panels, you have to have the batteries in your house, all the copper and everything associated with that. There's maintenance issues. And, you know, I think it's pretty reliable, but it's not 100%. What happens when it goes bad? What do you do with the old batteries when they're no good anymore? And how often those have to be replaced? And everybody in the country with solar panels and batteries, there's a whole industry of collecting up whatever battery technology you use. Right now, I think the only viable one is really the lead acid type. That's like car batteries. You know, there's lithium ions, but at some point, is lithium going to be in the raw material in short supply? I don't know.
Okay. Iris Kaminsky has her hand up. And Mary, so Iris, you're next to ask a question. And Mary Woolsey wants to know if you are suggesting that the regulatory hurdles to new nuclear plants could be reduced without significant risk.
You know, I really don't know the answer to that, because if you let the regulatory requirements lapse, people are going to take advantage of it. You know, it's I think that the hurdles should be really technological and not bureaucratic. And if there are real reason, good technological reasons not to go forward, it's, or something to be addressed, really has to be done. But I think there has to be regulatory, you know, it has to be very highly regulated.
Yeah.
Either or the government could take it over. You know, we don't like that in America. We think it should all be private, but the United States government can say that power generation is a critical need of this country, and the U.S. government's going to run it, come up with one particular type of reactor that's proven technology. Look, they have reactors, aircraft carriers, go 30 knots. The ship the size of a city goes 30 knots in the ocean, and it runs for 20 years without refueling. Or nuclear reactors on these ships. Why not have the Navy design a nuclear reactor for every town and have a, you know, like a ship's reactor, you know, Nimitz class aircraft carrier has a super high tech nuclear reactor, no maintenance for 20 years on the reactor itself, no refueling, 30 knots, you can go 30 knots power. You know, as I told you, it's 100 million barrels of oil is one barrel of uranium. And that is, you know, that's the,
yeah.
Handling of the waste is a real problem, though. That's something that we decided we're not going to solve. It's basically, that was Jimmy Carter. I actually voted for Jimmy Carter, and then I was a little bit disappointed when he said that U.S. is going to reprocess fuel. That was a long time ago.
Okay, Iris, what is your question?
So I missed part of it, so I don't know if you answered this, but I understand that Connecticut has two nuclear energy plants, and they're supposed to be out phased, or one in 2035 and one in 2045. So what's the recommendation to keep them going or to start new generation nuclear reaction?
Yeah, my impression was like the Yankee nuclear plant is really at the end of its life expectancy. You know, the idea was you have these plants and they run 20 to 40 years and then you build a new one. A lot of these plants actually have run longer than their original design lifetime. I'm not sure about the Connecticut ones. I used to know about this, but I can't remember.
So the ideal is to have new ones and for example?
You cycle in a new one and,
okay.
You know, they're kind of, there's, you know, they're billions of dollars to build, but they, you know, if you run for 40 years, you know, everything costs a lot now. And our new science building at Yale was over $100 million. So nowadays, $1 billion isn't that much money.
So yeah.
It is to me, but you know, to building stuff, it's just not that much.
Yes. So Aaron Good points out that Connecticut Yankee closed 25 years ago, and Millstone is the only nuclear power plant still operating in Connecticut. And Aaron also points out there were stories recently about a high-level Department of Defense laboratory reopening investigations into cold fusion technology. He wants to know if this is for real or just a misinterpretation of experimental data leading to another dead end.
Yeah, well, the cold fusion's been pretty well proven to be bad science. It just, you know, it's just not there. I wish it was, but I don't know why the Department of Energy is doing that. I think there's political pressure. There's a lot of people that say it's just all being suppressed, but it's been really very highly tested. In fact, one of the leading experiments was done right here at Yale, right in the nuclear lab by Moshe Guy, about the time that the cold fusion first came out. There's been enough people working on it now that cold fusion was possible. We have cold fusion reactors. Someone would have done it. There's too much money to be made. And so yeah. I think the lack of existence is a proof that it doesn't really work. It's one of these mythological things that it's like looking for the Holy Grail. It probably doesn't exist, but people keep looking for it.
So Kristen asks, what is the design lifetime of the new nuclear plants?
You know, I don't really know that much about it. You know, my knowledge is limited to these more fundamental questions. And I think that, you know, probably a newly designed plant, really 40 years or something like that is a long time. And the idea is at some point, you know, you have to be, you know, the Navy 20 years for their reactors. I think 20 years is a reasonable length of time. You know, stuff gets old. You know, if you want to drive a 20-year-old car, how many parts do you replace? Keep the system good. And, you know, sort of, I think regardless of the technology, it's, you know, you can think about both having buildings where you have a reactor that you can change out the main part of it, keep the building, that infrastructure, so you don't have to rebuild the whole thing. But current designs has the whole thing being rebuilt every time you have to do And even then, though, even maybe the building has to be replaced. Two of these are, there's containment domes and all that. There's concrete, that stuff. Concrete wears out over wintering. You know, concrete begins to break down after a while. You'll see that on highways to some degree. So maybe even the buildings have to be replaced. I don't know, but getting something lasts more than 20 years isn't that easy. You know, if it's really doing something, you know, you can build a pyramid that lasts tens of thousands of years, you know, and actually their pyramids are in pretty bad shape on the outside anyway, but you know, if you have something that's actually working and doing something, it's a little bit difficult to have something that's going to last indefinitely.
Okay, so Kathy Fay asks, has anyone actually conducted cradle to end of waste storage time comparative analyses of various generation scenarios? And if so, have others found significant externalities that have not been factored into their analyses?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I think it's been done, but you know, these stuff isn't so publicly available because for whatever reason, you know, if you're trying to promote a technology, you don't want all the aspects of it to be known. And you know, there's a lot of competitiveness between different industrial ideas. A colleague of mine at Los Alamos actually had an idea for the high definition television signal system. You know, that we all had to convert our TVs, the old ones wouldn't work anymore. Well, he had an idea. You could have high definition TV without having to change it. The old TV would work fine. You could buy a new one and enjoy high definition at the whole thing. There was a demonstration project at Los Alamos and one Eastern country, I think Indonesia, adopted this technology as their national television standard. Well, after he came up with this idea and was trying to promote it, he actually got death threats from people. And, you know, his technique required less bandwidth, less signal bandwidth. You know, there's information requires some frequency range, and his actually required half the bandwidth. So it would cut down electric power use on television transmissions, and it was a really good thing, but it was basically he dropped it after he started getting death threats. It's because people didn't want their technology to be threatened by some other technology. I never would have believed that would have happened unless I had experienced it directly myself in a real situation, something I know. So there's a lot of competition between these different ideas. And in the end, there's always somebody wants to make money off of it. And that's eventually what ends up driving a lot of this stuff. And so a lot of times you don't see all the information that exists regarding problems with something. Basically, because nobody wants to hear the bad news. And they keep it suppressed. And, you know, maybe there's nothing, maybe there's something, but I'm sure there's engineering studies of this that tell the true costs of things. You know, these are called the true costs. And, you know, it's an interesting research project to find that out, right? Just look at everything. That's my point of the talk today. Just look at everything. How much copper, how much concrete do you need? What are you going to do with the waste batteries? How often do you need to replace? What do you do with your nuclear waste? How dangerous is the processing of fuel, making it, transporting it? How bad is a proliferation issue, you know, people getting nuclear waste or getting, you know, we decide to go to breeder reactors, what's the chance somebody's going to get U-233 and make a bomb? You know, I think it's actually extraordinarily low. I think this proliferation issue is a non-issue, but, you know, that's just my opinion. Maybe somebody at the CIA to study or the FBI knows, but exactly people or governments or terrorist groups are planning to do about resources they have. So, you know, there's questions. There's a lot of them. The whole point is no solution is perfect. What's the least imperfect one? That's going to meet the needs.
Okay. Thank you. So Kathy Fay remarks that we are very fortunate to have a speaker like you available to us. Even if you do give us more questions than answers, which is good, we need to ask questions. And she also notes that we, the Environmental Advisory Council, have expressed concerns about radioactive fracking waste material. We teamed up with environmental groups in many municipalities in Connecticut, and we passed fracking waste disposal bans in our municipalities and sent our state delegations to try to ban fracking waste disposal in the state where things got all bollocksed up. But
not to prolong this, but look what happened, the local reactor phenomenon. You make this uranium material move with the water. Once it hits a marsh, a swampy marsh, and it's reducing atmosphere, it's going to condense out. It's going to be in the mud for as long as we live, and it's going to keep concentrating. It's worse than mercury pollution, so you did the right thing there. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. So Kathy wants to know if the amount of radioactive waste would be the same if uranium were being fracked rather than gas.
Right now, they could be collecting that uranium that's coming out in the fracking. Maybe it's not concentrated enough to be useful. But I think you really set up the uranium mining thing like I showed, where you do the in situ leaching. Any uranium you lose to the environment is profit you're losing. So I would think that you would not really be releasing anything to the environment. You'd be collecting everything.
But they're not. Is that what you...
I'm saying the oil fracking right now. No, they're not. Yeah, they're just letting it go.
But they should be.
It's probably not concentrated enough to be practical.
Yeah.
But, it's just, if it gets in the ground, if it goes out with wastewater and ends up in a reducing atmosphere, the uranium precipitates out. It just happens. We know from geological evidence, and the chemistry of the actinides is well known. And it's going to collect. And Connecticut's full of marshes, stinking, rotting marshes everywhere. And that's just exactly what you need to form a uranium ore deposit. Basically, that's what you're doing. You're dumping fracking water into a environment like around Connecticut, Pennsylvania, where it's marshy and swampy. It's just going to persist in the mud of the water forever and continue to accumulate. And that's how geological ores form.
Wow. So maybe they should have found a way to collect the uranium while they were at this fracking of oil and gas.
Probably not. You can't really do it for the uranium. The specific guy case I talked about was you can actually use this for uranium mining. They're moving such little fluid for that, so they can really extract a high degree of uranium. But the stuff that comes out of a fracking well is just muck and goop and so much of it that really... You spend more energy processing that material than you would gain in energy, which is what you have to look at. If you're really going to do fracking, handle the waste properly, that's the energy return on investment goes into handling that material in a proper way. It could be if that's done, the fracking is not commercially or viable. And, it's one of the things you have to look at. And maybe the fracking waste is fine. You keep it in a pond and then bury it after you've been doing it. That might work in some areas, and letting that fracking water go, then that's another issue. And you have to really make sure that everything's precipitated out before you'll the wastewater go from these things. Any of those parts per million of uranium, that's actually a lot.
Oh boy. I would just like to note that we have been joined by Kristen Gorton, another Environmental Advisory Council member. And yes, Steve, you have given us a lot of food for thought. Anybody have any more questions to ask?
Yes, I have a question, Florstein. It's not so much a question as a statement. You were very technical and you took me to a place I've never gone. However, I still need to review some of the material that you spoke about. I wonder, is there any way we can get a copy of your PowerPoint?
Yeah, I'll send it to Laura.
Okay.
I'll take out the couple of joke slides and then I'll send it to Laura.
Okay, thank you. Very informative.
The advantage of being a Republican is I can make fun of them. I'm a registered Republican, just for full disclosure, just because I just never bothered changing the fact the party is not the same as it was. But so anyway, I'll take out my joke slides and send it to the.
Oh, you can send the whole thing.
No, I won't. I don't want a Trump supporter coming to my house and shooting me or something.
Good idea. Keep it to myself. I wouldn't do it loud. To come your way.
You just got to make jokes about politics anymore, so I'll take it. Okay. Yes. Thank you all for your attention.
Thank you so much, Steve. You have been so informative and so thought-provoking. We're going to have to spend the entire summer thinking about this, and I'm sure some of us are going to have lots of questions to ask you in the future, so stick around.
Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Lamoureux.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And best luck with your efforts.
Thank you.
Thanks. Kathy says thanks. Kristen says thanks. Okay, so thank you very much. I know it was a little hard to hear Steve, but we will have a copy of the facts he presented so everybody can look at them and we can do our own research to follow up. I think these are just things to consider when we are advocating for future energy, just that we need to think about all aspects of everything and the perception versus the reality, which I didn't think about before, but it's fascinating how what we find out in the media is not necessarily the truth, although we now know that. So anyway, okay. So, great. So I don't know if any of you saw the link I put in the chat box near the beginning for the Monsanto Roundup trial tracker, but it's getting more and more drawn out and bigger and bigger. It's now up to $13 billion in a class action settlement, and they're still not done, and they're not going to stop selling Roundup, which is remarkable. So even though it's costing Monsanto, now Bayer, this much money, they're not going to sell it, stop selling it. All right. So I have updates on 4 city issues, and then anybody else who has any committee reports can give them. So the English Station remediation, IRIS is working diligently on compiling a list of questions for DEEP about the 40-page test sample report they sent us and all the other documents we have received, and on finding us experts to advise us on next steps. The Wheeler Street Transfer Station, as you know, their permit is up for renewal in December, and the Environmental Advisory Council has drafted a letter to send to DEEP requesting that they actually inspect the plant before they renew the permit, which they don't seem to have necessarily done in the past. The bird safe buildings legislation, I have an update from city planner Jamie Stein. She says we have a new director of zoning. William Long joined us about 3 weeks ago. We're working on a package of zoning text amendments that are sustainability focused. Within that package are the inclusion of bird safe guidelines as a candidate for density bonuses. The package is not quite ready for prime time, but once our new zoning director gets his footing, we hope to move them forward. So maybe we'll see them in September. And the leaf blower legislation, there is a committee led by Pavla Rosenstein. They have met several times. Pavla has brought advocates from other Connecticut municipalities and other states and Washington, D.C. to share their knowledge with us. And we'll try to work on this, the issue of limiting leaf blowers at the city and state level. And we are considering inviting someone from EPA to discuss this and other noise issues at our September meeting. And the EAC has adopted a letter that the people in Montclair, New Jersey drafted to hand out to people who are using leaf blowers to inform them about some of the environmental dangers of leaf blowers, because we think people don't know enough about them. So anyway, those are the updates I have. And anyway, does anybody else have any updates? Florestine. Oh, Florestine's building is working on solar panels. The Florestine is working on that. Good going, Florestine.
Yeah, it's come along well. We've done a lot of research and we're working on it and looking at a time frame. And it's coming along. A lot of potential for what's going to happen. In fact, Kathy, I want to tell Kathy I want to get back to her. I'll contact her.
Okay. And Aaron writes, if folks want to get involved with the leaf blower working group, they can contact Pavla. I have her information if you want her. She's, you know, pavla.rosenstein@yale.edu, I think. So,
I just want to update on the water committee that I've been to. Good. Real quickly. So basically we're nearly out of drought, but there's still a lot of concerns about that because of, you know, we did have a lot of rain. But regarding the leaf blowers, I did bring up the matter of the leaf blowers of being that oil spills and gas spills from the leaf blowers and from garden equipment. I asked if they could be used on watershed property or near water resources, because in Connecticut we have regulations that you're not allowed to have, for example, a gas station within, now somebody could correct me, 500 feet or from a water resource or from the water watershed. Anyway, there's a limitation of area that you cannot have, for example, a gas station. So I asked if using gas blowers, gas operated blowers, if that's significant, if a spill, let's say somebody spills 1 gallon, not a huge spill. And they said it's significant and they're going to look into that. So I think who people here who are involved in watershed communities should bring that up to their people.
What people?
To the committees that they're involved. So the number is that annually there are like 17 million gallons spilled in all the United States every summer because of operating these yard machines, the leaf blowers and the lawn mowers. That's annually. So annually we're spilling in the ground something larger than those spills that once in a decade we have from Exxon or BP. So, but because they're spread over the whole ground of the United States, it's not being addressed. Only commercial operators, if they have a big spill, it will be addressed. But for the small users, there's no concern. And we in New Haven, for example, we don't have private wells. So if I spill oil in my yard, nobody cares, nobody would know. So I'm just bringing that up to be cautious. And there's one more reason why not to use these gas operated machines.
Yeah. Thanks, Iris.
You're welcome.
Yes. So anyone have anything else to say about leaf blowers or water? The primary concern. Oh, there are many concerns about leaf blowers, Kristen. I'll send you a copy of the letter the Environmental Advisory Council proposes to send to show to anybody who's interested. But there are concerns about noise and air pollution and stripping soil and spreading pesticides and animal feces and wrecking the ground and causing people to go deaf and all kinds of, plus the fuel and the emissions and the particulate matter and all kinds of other stuff. So it is a multitude of sins. Aaron emailed or put in the chat about the bottle bill. I don't know if any of you know, but there's a bill. So we're almost at the end of the Connecticut General Assembly session. It ends June 7th, I believe. And June 7th or 9th. I have it written down somewhere. Anyway, there's a bill that's been going through the legislature to try to modernize the redemption of bottles. It's June 9th, Aaron says. It ends June 9th. So anyway, the bottle bill is attempting to raise the redemption fee for bottles from 5 cents to 10 cents and do various other important things like put reverse vending machines in smaller places and up the processing fees so that people will be more invested in doing the processing. And I think it's about to go to a vote, if I'm not mistaken, at the Senate, the Connecticut State Senate. And we hope it will pass there. Of course, everyone from the industry has been lobbying against the passage of this bill. And we think that this is long in need of updating. And IRIS, of course, would like the redemption fee to be more like 25 or 30 cents, but we're doing the best we can. We will start somewhere and hope for more later. So yes, now let's see. Yeah. Okay. Can everyone see the chat? Well, Iris put in the chat. Oh, there, Mary Woolsey writes, there's a leaf blower meeting tomorrow. So get in touch with Pavla if you're interested. So if anyone needs her email, you can ask me or you can ask Mary and we can connect you. Iris writes, the primary concern for gas operated leaf blowers is the machine is not efficient and uses only part of the gasoline to operate because it's a two-stroke engine. The rest evaporates and the person who operates these machines breathes it, and this, and it also causes local air pollution, among other things. And Mary also notes the Transportation Climate Initiative is before the legislature. And if you want more information, you can contact Mary about that. We have many things going on right now. There is a very simple bill that's in the state legislature that would digitize pesticide application records, which is very important because at the moment, people can get away with applying pesticides, lawn chemicals that New Haven has a voluntary ban on these. The reason New Haven has a voluntary ban is that they're controlled by the state and the city municipalities are not allowed to regulate them, but the Environmental Advisory Council prevailed upon the Board of Alders to pass a ban in New Haven on pesticides. But of course it's not enforceable. And the first step to getting people to stop using this stuff is for us to know how much of it's being used, where and when, and if the pest and the that all that information is not on the application records, but any amount of information such as how much of the stuff an entity uses each year is in the records, and digitizing them, putting them online would be so much simpler because at the moment they are submitted on paper. DEEP can't get to them right now because DEEP hasn't been in their office since last March and they're not going back until July. So I've asked for some of Yale's pesticide application records and I can't get them from 2020. Yale won't give them up, not to me or to anybody else. And no one can get hold of them because they're probably somewhere in a piece of paper and or pieces of paper because Yale submits many of them. And all of the other commercial pesticide applicators who submit these records, they do it on paper. They don't have to do it online. And the public does not have access to them no matter how they do. And we need to get things modernized. And the Connecticut General Assembly Environment Committee voted in favor of this very simple bill to digitize these records, which would save a lot of resources for DEEP because they wouldn't have to file them in boxes, keep them, get them out when people wanted to see them, et cetera. But I think it's gone nowhere, which is sad because, here we are in the middle of a pandemic. And I don't know about the rest of you, but in my neighborhood, you can smell poison air when True Green and TLC, the lawn company, and other people spray pesticides all over lawns, and it's quite distressing. Okay, Mary Woolsey is, I'm going to read her her email address for you, mlswoolsey@gmail.com. And if anybody can't find her email address, you can ask me. And she writes, TCI particularly needs support from medical and public health folks. So does anyone have anything else to report?
There's going to be a rally or press conference in Raleigh at 11:30 on Friday regarding a transportation climate initiative at the Capitol, state Capitol.
Okay. Are you going, Florestine?
I'm planning to go if it's not 100 degrees outside.
Ah, well, I will look forward to seeing you on the news.
No, I'm going to try to make it for sure.
Great. Okay. Well, if anybody has anything else, now's the time to speak up. Reminder, we are not going to meet again until September, but we will be working during the summer. So anybody else have anything? Okay. Thank you all very, very much for attending this meeting. As you